Welcome to your Aged Care Compass podcast. We help you make sense of the Australian aged care system by having conversations about topics you've asked us about. We're joined by thought leaders, professional experts, and people just like you and I who talk about their experience in the aged care sector. Welcome to today's episode of your Aged Care Compass podcast. I'm Coral, your host, and today I'm joined by Dr. Roseanne Freak-Poley. Roseanne is a life course epidemiologist and senior researcher at Monash University. Roseanne is recognised internationally for her expertise in loneliness and her chapter on loneliness and social isolation in the Cambridge Handbook of Loneliness is in press. Roseanne, you describe yourself as being a life course epidemiologist. What does that mean?
I like to think about factors that occur earlier in life or over the life course and how that affects our health and well-being later in life. I'm specifically focused on social determinants of health, which are non-medical factors that influence health and well-being. And these can be conditions in which we are born, work, live, age, and grow.
Is there a reason or a story behind why your interest lies with how often disease occurs in different groups of people and why?
The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. However, our current model of health is heavily focused on physical and more recently the mental health components. I've studied as an undergraduate psychology, public health, and statistics. So I wanted to bring attention to the importance of social health in its own right. And to do this, what I wanted to do is develop the evidence base on how social isolation and loneliness impacts physical and mental health. I think it's important for medical people and professional, as well as the general population, understand the impact of social well-being for their longevity. And in fact, the World Health Organization has just released a report at the end of June 2025 titled From Loneliness to Social Connection. They state that social isolation and loneliness are widespread and serious but under-recognized impacts on health, well-being, and society.
Roseanne, is there a difference between loneliness and social isolation?
I'm going to start with the definitions. So social isolation is around a number of social connections that you may have in a week or a month. Social isolation indicates the low level of contact with family and friends, participation in social activities, and integration into the wider community and social environment. Whereas loneliness is a subjective, distressing emotional state in which someone perceives a discrepancy between the desired and actual social relationships. There's also another component that's often discussed called social support. And this is how people utilize their social connections. It's a subjective perception, or it could reflect their actual circumstance of the availability of social resources from others. Now, that's very technical based, but essentially what I'm trying to say is that social isolation and social support are perceptive. So someone could have one or two friends, but if they feel supported by them, they're less likely to feel lonely. However, some people may have a lot of contacts but not feel the social support from them. And there are different types of loneliness, if you get really into it, that reflects these different components, which I won't be talking to in too much detail today.
Okay, well, look, that was very clear to me and really actually quite enlightening that you can have only a couple of social supports but not feel isolated and not feel lonely. Is that correct? Did I interpret that correctly?
That's correct. So if I just focus on loneliness and social isolation, if you have both of those, it's not good, but it can make some sense to people that you're socially isolated and lonely. Whereas when you don't have social isolation and you're not lonely, that also makes sense and that is a positive outcome. However, some people feel lonely, but they're not socially isolated.
Right.
And that does make some sense in the sense that they may be alone in the crowd. So I often think about people in a residential aged care facility where they have a lot of interactions, they have a lot of people around them, but they're not feeling like they're getting that social connection. Then there's another element, which is someone's not lonely, but they're socially isolated. So they have very few contacts, but those contacts, they're receiving the social support, and or they may just enjoy their solitude and it may not be an issue for them.
Right. Excellent. Thank you. In your research from 2018 to 22 into loneliness and social isolation, you demonstrated that social health is associated with a greater severity of chronic disease risk factors, lower quality of life, increased risk of cardiovascular disease and dementia. Talk us through what this means for people listening in today.
So I'll explain through just one example of the type of research that I've been doing. I generally have looked at people aged 65 years or more, and in the Esprit cohort, originally it was a cohort looking at a randomized controlled trial of low-dose aspirin. However, there was no benefit or negative associated with the aspirin on the outcomes. So it's turned into this lovely cohort study, and they had a huge range of social determinants, including social health. And here I've been able to look at the difference between social isolation, social support, and loneliness on cardiovascular disease risk, as well as dementia risk. And as an example, I have found that if you're socially isolated at baseline, so this is a healthy cohort that have reached age 65 years or more, you have 66% increased risk of having a cardiovascular disease event in the next 5 years. If you have low social support, then you have a double risk or 200% risk of having a cardiovascular disease event in the next 5 years. And if you're lonely, you have 255% increased risk of dying from a cardiovascular disease event. So that's the type of research I've been doing. But as a summative information, a digestible way of thinking about it of all over, like all my research in the last 5 years, I've come up with some sort of public health messages. And that is that if you're feeling lonely, as in it's occurring 3 or more days per week, then someone should seek help, which means that they should go and see their general practitioner or someone else that's allied health, or talk to someone in a community neighbourhood house, for instance.
Those statistics have really jumped out at me. That sounds very alarming to me. Is that a fair comment?
It is alarming, and that's part of the reason why I was trying to get this evidence base, because it is so strongly associated with well-being, quality of life, longevity. Like, living a good, healthy life is not just about physical health. It's mental health, it's social health. So it's all connected.
Wow. Are there different pathways in how social isolation and loneliness impact health?
Yes. So the way I've theorized it from all the literature that I've been reading is that if someone is socially isolated, it's a reduced contact and also reduced accessing resources that are available. And this has a tendency to impact people's lifestyle behaviors. So they may eat more unhealthily, do less physical activity, these types of lifestyle behaviours that then influence your physical or mental health. Whereas if you're lonely, you have a tendency to have a stress or anxiety response from the loneliness, which then impacts more the biological mechanisms that impact mental ill health and physical ill health. So that's not a hard and fast rule, but there are different pathways.
This is so interesting. So if someone was listening in today who felt they might want to increase their social connectedness, what are some simple things that they could do?
There are a range of Australian-wide social resources that are available in nearly all the locations. There is Australian Music Communities, and if you type that in with a map, you can use this interactive map that is online. There are book clubs, choirs. There's an Ending Loneliness Together directory, which means that you can look up your area and see what's available. There's Heart Foundation walking groups, men's sheds. There's something else called My Community directory. Neighbourhood houses have a lot of activities. Some are paid, some are unpaid. Local councils have a range of activities that they advertise, and this can be on their website, or sometimes they have a printout booklet that you can ask for. Park Run also do park walks, and local public libraries have a range of courses that you may meet people through, as well as sometimes drop-in chats. There's also the University of the Third Age for people who are age over 65 who may want to engage in a hobby or just further education for themselves. So these are national resources. However, every community has additional resources that you can find, preferably through your community houses or through the councils.
Some of those programs I'm certainly aware of. They run in my neighbourhood and location, but a lot of those I wasn't aware of as well. So we'll put the links to as many of those as we can in the show notes so people can follow up and see if they're available in their area as well. So from your research, did you find that there was a difference between men and women with regards to how prevalent loneliness was?
We found that women tend to have more social interaction, have more social support, but feel more lonely. So it's a bit counterintuitive in that sense. And the way we think about it is that historically, particularly in the cohorts I've been looking at that are age 65 years or more, we have had a social historical context with how gender plays out in our society. So men have tended to be the breadwinners and go to work, whereas women have tended to be the homemakers and have been more heavily dependent on social connection for their interactions, whereas men have gone to the workplace and have had that social interaction automatically. So once you remove the workplace, then women have maybe a certain need or higher need, particularly in the older age groups, to have a social connection, whereas maybe that's not in place for men. However, there's another factor, which is that women may be more likely or more comfortable reporting their loneliness than men. So we're not absolutely sure why we see these patterns. However, there are gender differences in social health.
Roseanne, on that note, do you have different recommendations then for men and women?
Well, what I've found is that actually the recommendations end up being very similar when I look across the different outcomes, being dementia risk and cardiovascular risk, but it's for different reasons. For instance, I would say that people should engage in informal caregiving at least once a week. So this could be babysitting or childminding or a person with illness or disability, which includes volunteering to help these cohorts. Now, for women, the act of engaging in informal caregiving for a person with illness and disability reduces the risk or is associated with a reduced risk of dementia. But that same activity is associated with a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease for men.
Really?
So the public health messages are very similar. Now, some of the other public health messages I would say is participating in community activities at least once per month, as well as seeking help for feelings of loneliness if they're occurring 3 or more days per week, having contact with 4 or more relatives or close friends per month. So this could be email, phone, video conferencing, text messaging. It's not necessarily in person. And then there's this magic number around 3. So the aim is to have 3 or 4 relatives or close friends with whom to discuss private matters or call on for help. Now, you can count the person twice if you can discuss private matters and call on for help. And again, we've seen a gender difference here, whereas women are more reliant on friends, close friends, whereas men tend to be more reliant on relatives for these interactions. I also want to bring attention here that 3 seems to be a much lower number than I thought it would be when I first started the research. And I think it really comes back to that message that we tell our kids when they go to school, which is you only really need 1 or 2 close friends. And I think that's the case as we go through our lives. We don't need a huge network for our physical risk associated with our socializing or social health.
I think that's a really important message. And certainly 3 people and contact 3 to 4 times a month is absolutely achievable, isn't it? When you discuss text messaging or a phone call, to me that seems absolutely doable. So I'm really glad you highlighted that point, that it's not something that's going to take an extraordinary amount of time or effort for people who actually need to engage more with those that care about them and who are around them.
That's right. And if you are struggling to reach these recommendations, I would say that volunteering is a really great way of meeting people and engaging with people beyond like a transactional, which is like you go to a shop and, you know, you buy something and there's no real depth to that conversation. Whereas if you volunteer, you'll be around like-minded people, you'll have conversations that are over time. And that's a really important aspect of social connection.
Community pharmacies keep Australia healthy. With 6,000 locations nationwide, they're open early, late and longer for convenient, accessible and safe care. Pharmacists provide home medicine reviews, dose administration aids and essential vaccinations. Thanks to additional training, many can now treat common conditions like ear infections, wounds and skin issues. They also support management of chronic conditions in partnership with your healthcare team. Ask your pharmacist how they can help you and your family stay well. And this leads perfectly into our next talking point, and that is that last week's episode, I spoke with Philippa O'Donnell of the FNQ Volunteers, which is my local office of the Aged Care Volunteer Visitor Scheme. Philippa revealed that the government has continued funding this excellent befriending program for the next 5 years, which she was really excited about because the funding has previously only been for a term of 3 years. Are you able to talk about your work presently? Because I know you're evaluating this scheme and possibly it's too early, but anyway, are you able to talk about any points, anything that you're seeing in evaluating this scheme at this time, Roseanne?
Yes, I am involved in the current evaluation of the Aged Care Volunteer Visitor Scheme, which is led by Dr. Barbara Bavosa-Nevis at the University of Sydney. The program itself links volunteers with people receiving aged care subsidy. So these are people in residential aged care facilities or in their own home. And I particularly want to draw the attention to the fact that to get the aged care subsidy, they're actually in really poor health. So they're quite vulnerable if you think about this population. They may have mobility issues, hearing issues, pain issues. And what we're doing is undertaking extensive evaluation using qualitative focus groups, which is analysing interview data. And then we're also undertaking quantitative surveys of over 500 people over time to see the benefits over time of this program. Unfortunately, consistent with current evidence, is that a group who are in poor health, such as this cohort, have a high percentage of people that are experiencing loneliness. So it is really a great target audience for the government. However, when we do talk to the recipients and the volunteer visitors, they both say how rewarding the program is and they highly recommend participating. And we know that the benefits to health and well-being of volunteering in other research is there, and this program is no exception, that there are benefits to that volunteering for the volunteers.
Absolutely. I really look forward to seeing the results of this evaluation. Roseanne, would it be fair to say that the government is acknowledging the importance of social connection in optimising health and well-being, particularly in relation to the findings of your previous and current research?
So I think the government is not only acknowledging the importance of social connection, but also the importance of quality of life rather than simply living longer. So to put this simply, what's the point in living longer if you're not enjoying it? And I'm aiming to extend healthy, active years where people are finding enjoyment, they're following their interests, they may be re-engaging with some interests that they've forgotten about when they were younger. And I think that this is a really important focus moving forward, considering the World Health Organization is putting a huge emphasis on social connection for health.
This is wonderful. I love this. And look, I was listening to your 2024, last year's interview on the ABC's Northern Tasmania Drive program, and I was so excited to hear you discuss that people who receive a home care package as being a particular focus for your work. I've had many discussions over the past few months with home care providers about the importance of keeping their clients connected to community. And the providers I've had on the show are all doing amazing things to ensure that their clients are maintaining social connection. I knew how important this was working in this space, but unlike you, the researcher, I didn't have the evidence to demonstrate this. The point that I'm making here is that I would like to encourage home care providers to actively include social support and community connection within the care plans of their clients. Domestic assistance, meals, and personal care that people may need support with is vital, but ensuring that older people retain their social connections is as important to optimising their health and well-being, and as you just said, their quality of life. So for home care providers listening in today, what would your recommendation be about how often they should consider including social support within service provision?
So first of all, I want to acknowledge how difficult it is in aged care facilities regarding staffing issues as it is. You know, I hear stories of understaffing or just other complications. So when we're talking about social health in aged care facilities, it is sometimes not the top priority. However, people are doing amazing things, as you discussed. And I do know, for instance, there are fantastic schedules to get people involved with other residents inside aged care facilities, as well as excursion buses and that are available with taking people out and about. Sometimes these excursions don't have to be elaborate. You could just be taking them to a park for them to sit somewhere different. Like, it's not necessarily about entry fees. It can be quite simple. Now, the other thing is that from my interactions with people in aged care facilities, I do know there is difficulty for them to socialise with people at their facilities. And this could be because of many reasons such as mobility, hearings, and also memory loss. So people make strong connections and then they're not able to be maintained. And that can be quite hurtful. You're grieving these relationships. It's difficult to make new ones. So if there are opportunities to have people visit of any age, that would be a fantastic option. So people coming in, fresh faces is always a benefit. Now, there is a TV show called Old Person's Home for 4-year-olds. I'm not sure if you've seen
it. I have. It's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah. And it demonstrates the benefits of cross-generational interaction for both the younger people and older participants. And my favourite participant was, I wanted to say for a better word, I don't know a better word, but grumpy old man. And he did not want to participate at all. And at the end, he was totally converted. He loved it. He was looking forward to the family visit right at the end where the family comes with the 4-year-old to the centre. And I just think it just shows how much we actually need that connection, even people that don't realise they need the connection.
Absolutely. I do. And I do remember that episode. I watched all of them. And I would just love to see that model widespread across the country. So valuable for, well, for the older people, but the kids as well and their parents. Yeah, amazing project that one was. You just mentioned that for people who aren't mobile, that can certainly present some challenges. If people weren't mobile and struggled to access the community, are there other interventions or support that could be provided to ensure that a person retained their social connection?
Yeah, it is difficult once you start having issues, particularly around mobility. I would say that if someone is in a situation like this and potentially listeners, that there are three phone numbers I'm going to share now, and they all can steer you in the right direction. So one is Beyond Blue. Their number is 1300 224 636. Now, these three phone numbers have other reasons that they're available, but one of them is around social connection. The second one is called Friendline, and it's 1-800-4-CHATS. So it's 1-800-424 2287. The third phone number is Lifeline Australia, which is 131114.
Fantastic. I hadn't heard of that one friend line, but I'm going to look it up after our chat today, and we will have all those numbers in our show notes today as well. So, Roseanne, is there a point where loneliness becomes a mood disorder? And if a family member or carer became aware the loneliness was perhaps something more than loneliness in their loved one, what should they do?
So here I'd be careful around medicalizing loneliness.
Right.
It's conceptualized as an indicator like thirst or hunger. So it's actually indicating that something needs to change in your lifestyle rather than a medicalized approach to it. Now, if you did see that you have a family member or someone that you care about that may potentially be lonely, I'd say to try to talk to them about the available resources that I've discussed today.
Yep.
Now, there is one intervention or program approach that we're trying to promote here in Australia that is actually part of the universal healthcare in the UK already. And it's called social prescribing. This is where people who are in health or allied health can prescribe social activities, not just medical prescriptions. And the best model is actually to prescribe someone to a link worker or social connector, which then they have time and capacity and an understanding of the community context to be able to create a personalized, tailored plan for each individual about their interests and their hobbies, and then continue following up with them over a 3-month period. Now, we're advocating for that in Australia, but there are some places that already have link workers. And if you're interested as your health professionals, you can ask your primary healthcare network to see if that's available in your current location.
Right. Okay. I've just made a note of that. I just became aware of social prescribing as well. And in fact, our episode of 2 weeks ago features a pharmacist in Perth, Carly Thompson, and Catherine Ewan of DaVita, which is one of the national home care providers who have initiated a social prescribing program. And it's just fascinating. And I think what the take-home message for me was that it was simple and it, well, I guess cost-effective. It wasn't expensive. It wasn't anything elaborate. It wasn't something that was taking a lot of time to implement. It was such a simple strategy and they're having great results. So I'm really excited to see this working in the space of community and with home care providers to see more social prescribing around the country in our locations. Is there anything else that you're aware of outside what pharmacists are doing at the moment with regards to social prescribing?
So first of all, if you are interested in social prescribing, I would say to sign up to the Aspire website newsletter, which is the Australian Social Prescribing Institute of Research and Education. They have an annual conference as well if you're interested in meeting people that are currently engaging in social prescribing. And also to listen out because the New South Wales Inquiry into Loneliness has quite heavily recommended social prescribing. So I'm sure there's going to be much more happening in this space in the next coming year. I know that a lot of general practitioners are attempting to do social prescribing themselves, even without the link workers. Park Run has been discussed quite extensively because it's national and it's local and it's free. We also know that neighbourhood houses have activities like a coffee catch-ups that are free that, you know, GPs are referring to get people out and about in the community. So it's definitely not isolated to pharmacists. A lot of allied health care professionals are already engaging in social prescribing with and without link workers.
Fantastic. Roseanne, today's discussion I've just found really fascinating. And there's actually quite a few points here that I'm going to go digging a bit deeper into for myself because I find the topic very interesting. I just want to say thank you for your time today. I know you are very busy with your work and applying for grants at the moment, but it's been wonderful having you on the show. And I think we might have to get you back at the end of your evaluation and have a chat again. So On behalf of all of our listeners today, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
It's been my pleasure. I'm looking forward to coming back. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode. Do you have a topic that you'd like us to cover on an episode? Please reach out and let us know via social media or our website, cmeacn.com.au. That's cmeacn.com.au. All the links are in the show notes. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes.